Yeah.
Welcome to yet another episode of the Lavender Fix podcast. I'm your host, Sabreen Hazik, and I hope you're not bored of me saying that at the beginning of every freaking episode. Well, it's another beautiful day with another beautiful journey of perseverance and resilience with yet another incredible human being. Today's episode is all about challenging the stigma of addiction, particularly alcohol addiction, with none other than Jenna DeLillo, a social media content creator from Virginia who is here with us to share her own personal journey to sobriety. But first, a few facts. According to Google, alcohol use disorder, also known as alcohol dependence, alcoholism, alcohol addiction, is a chronic disease characterized by uncontrolled drinking and preoccupation with alcohol. Alcoholism is the inability to control drinking due to both a physical and emotional dependence on alcohol. Symptoms include a strong need or urge to use alcohol, and those with alcohol use disorder may have problems controlling their drinking, continue to use alcohol even when it causes problems, or have withdrawal symptoms when they rapidly decrease or stop drinking. According to the Pan America Health Organization, alcohol consumption was responsible for an average 85,000 deaths annually during the period of 2013 to 2015 in America, where per capita consumption is 25% higher than the global average. If you're an avid listener of this podcast, you know that we are here to initiate change as a community, big or small, in whichever capacity. We are all about progress over perfection. If you or someone you know is looking for a sign or a starting point, this is it. Hello, Jenna. Welcome to the Lavender Fix podcast. You are officially part of the family.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Jenna, I just love how this is my third attempt at recording and you are just equally excited each time. I wasn't going to say this out loud, but our listeners have to know. You guys, I started recording and I was messing up, like, and Jenna was just, each time I asked her or said, "Welcome to the Lavender Fix," with the same enthusiasm each time. She was like, "I'm so happy to be here." And I'm thinking, Jenna, are you sure? Anyway, so first of all, Jenna, congratulations on how far you've come. I am really humbled that you chose the Lavender Fix to share your journey, not just with our community, but beyond. And, you know, it takes a lot to agree to do something like this because you're revisiting a lot of those not so nice memories. So I'm really proud of you. And before we dig into your experiences and what motivated you to take on this journey and reach a point where you're happy and healthy, tell me this. Who was Jenna before she got sober? Take me back in time.
Well, first of all, thank you so much. I appreciate all of those kind words. And again, for having me on, because this is quite the honor to be invited on and to be able to share my story. So me, Jenna, I would say before I got sober, you know, I grew up and I had a pretty like simple life. I grew up in West Virginia. I'm a 90s baby. I was born in the 80s, but grew up in the 90s. So I had a really simple childhood where I played outside and all of the things, and my life was simple, but I was pretty shy. I wasn't outgoing. I wasn't a part of like the popular crowd, right. I would say. Pretty reserved. Pretty much my whole life until getting sober, I always was nervous, never really would speak up or volunteer or lead on anything. And that carried into my adult life, kind of like always just a follower and whatever anybody else was really doing or taking the lead on. And pretty reserved.
Straightforward. Yeah. So you weren't like, you weren't wild, basically. You were a good kid.
Yeah, I was a rule follower.
Yeah.
Definitely. I think it comes to a surprise for a lot of people that I didn't start drinking until I was in college. I was very much like, wanted to get good grades and always like looking for praise from others of like, you're doing a good job. You're, you know, you're where you're supposed to be.
Sure. Yeah. No, of course. I think the reason I asked you that is just to, you know, later in the episode, we can juxtapose it with what happened, you know, once that vicious cycle started with alcohol consumption, right? So substance use disorders, you know, they're a significant public health concern and rank among the most common psychiatric disorders, you know, beginning in young childhood. In young adulthood, Sabrine. And these disorders are, you know, highly disabling. They frequently co-occur with and even exacerbate other mental and physical health problems. And a lot of the times, you know, you'll see a very strong familial pattern, right? There are different factors that lead to it. So everything has a root cause and it usually goes back to a person's childhood. So growing up, Jenna, do you think you understood alcoholism and or were you exposed to it in any capacity?
I didn't. As a child, I didn't until I got into high school. And I remember I took my very first psychology course. I understood throughout my life that alcoholism within my family was painful. I understood that when people in my family were drinking, it caused pain in my life. I was able to make that association at a very young age, but I didn't understand alcoholism and what it was until I took my very first psychology class in high school. I was 15 years old. And I remember my mind being blown during that time because I learned about what it was and that I did have it in my family. And I would say like I understood as a child, like I could make the correlation.
But beginning
in my teens, I definitely could see really what alcoholism was.
Was doing. You know, clearly to children, when they observe something affecting familial bonds or, you know, the health of relationships in their families, especially between their parents, they want to steer clear from it. Right. And it seems like alcohol was one of those things for you because you saw what it was doing in your own family. What changed? When was your first tryst with alcohol?
So with my addiction, like I remember my whole life, me looking at my family and I would say I will never be that. I absolutely hate that. You know, because it affected my relationship, especially that I have with my dad. We have a very good relationship now, but my relationship with my dad was affected my whole life because he had alcoholism and it changed who he was. It made him morph into this completely different person. And I would be like, we would have arguments and I would say, I'll never be you. I never want to be the person that you are. And in high school, I steered completely away from it. I was like, I'm never going to drink in high school. I remember I would be like, people are drinking at parties in high school, like being so just like shocked at this. And then in college, I didn't really drink until my sophomore year. I went to a party and somebody had alcohol there. And I was like, I've never even tried it. And people were shocked, you know, and they're like, just try it. And even it's so weird to me looking back, even that first night that I drank alcohol, I didn't have an off switch. Like someone had a bottle of wine. And I drank the entire bottle of wine, like so quickly, to the point where I couldn't walk. I couldn't stand. I was slurring my words. And that was the first time that I had like an experience with alcohol.
Yeah. And what do you think, you know, what pushed you to keep drinking that night? What do you think it was?
I think that, you know, when we look at alcoholism, I mean, there's different reasons that can cause the disease. You have environmental factors that can, and then you have, you know, genetic factors that can. I was born into the perfect storm where I had both, and I don't think I had control ever. I don't think there was ever a point in my life where I could say I was drinking and I had control of the situation. It was, it's kind of like I have a little bit and I keep wanting more until the only thing that prevents me from drinking more is that I'm unconscious and I can't.
Yeah. So, you know, from what I've heard, when people try alcohol for the first time, they usually don't like the taste of it. It's definitely a quiet taste. What did it feel like consuming alcohol for the first time for you?
I have to say this, because this is very interesting that you said, you brought it up, that alcohol is an acquired taste. It's really funny. People, I use this all the time. There have been studies done, and alcohol doesn't taste good. It's been proven time and time again. That's why we add juices and like these flavorings, because it really doesn't taste good. It's just cause of it the cause and effect of it, that it lowers our inhibitions and we feel loose and we feel, you know, more, I'm going to use air quotes, relaxed. But the first time that I consumed it, I can describe to you really what it feels like to consume alcohol physically, even now. It's like this almost like burning, tingling feeling in my chest and like a rush of, I remember feeling that little buzz and then not wanting, like wanting more of that feeling. Wanting more of that buzz, of that feeling of like, oh, like this is nice. I feel like less of my worries are there. Like I'm like out. Look, I'm dancing, which I don't really ever do.
I hear you.
More of like, just more of like. Like I can't describe of just wanting more and more. I remember drinking like half the bottle so quickly, and people were like, "You drank that much of you. This is your first time drinking. Drank that much." I'm like, "I want more. Like, does anybody have more that we can drink here?" Like, I actually.
Wow. Yeah, I mean that is incredible that you downed half a bottle. That's impressive, though. I have to say, as a child, like you were pretty young. You know. Do you think that there was any kind of peer pressure coming in at all, or no?
Yeah, there definitely was peer pressure, because everybody that I was with that night had already drank before. And so there definitely was a level of, come on, like,
you can do it.
Never tried this. You can at least try it. And at that age, obviously, binge drinking is more, it's a more appropriate in
I hear you.
In that age group, it's almost like you're encouraged to binge drink and to get really, really, really drunk.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a concern really to anybody, because that's what everybody does at that age when you're in college. You get together and you tie 40s to your hands and you drink like a crazy amount of alcohol.
And if you don't, and if you don't, you're sort of labeled, you know, as a loser or I agree with you. I mean, I've seen that firsthand. And, you know, I think that buzz that you were talking about, right? Alcohol, impacts inhibitions in many ways. You start doing things you've never done before. It affects the receptors in your brain and, you know, specifically neurotransmitters that act as, you know, the stimulants, stopping people from considering consequences. It affects that. So even though alcohol is a depressant substance, it is often used to get the party going. And many of us have tales of stupid things when, you know, stupid things that we've done when we were drunk, and they don't often involve mellowing out or going to sleep. So alcohol is not just a depressant then. It also acts on moods and emotions, actions, reactions. And alcohol in a way dispels anxiety. It makes it easier to feel more social, less afraid, and less aware of your surroundings. So, you know, you may find yourself in a situation that goes downhill fast and can become potentially dangerous many times. So have you ever found yourself in a strange or an awkward situation after blacking out?
Oh my gosh. There are too many to count. Yeah. So many times that I found myself in situations that I would wake up and think, I want to remember how I got there. Or there were, you know, several times where I had went, or someone was in my house that I didn't know how they got there.
Oh my God.
And those are scary moments when you have pieces of information that are just missing from your life, and you have to ask somebody else how your life was lived in moments because you can't put the pieces together. I don't think a lot of people realize, because I didn't even realize this until I got sober and I started really looking into the effects of drinking until the point of blacking out. And it's so dangerous, and it's so damaging in a permanent way, because you are essentially deleting brain cells when you're doing that.
Yeah.
And I've done it so many times in my life that I'm so thankful that, you know, I was able to recognize my disease early on, but a lot of people go too far for a really, really long time.
Absolutely. So, Jenna, of course, that night when you had alcohol for the first time, it wasn't a one-off event. It snowballed into something much larger, right? And considering you had an unhealthy relationship with your alcohol all throughout your 20s, do you think that if you were to look back now, that there was ever a situation in your life that made things worse?
Yes.
Okay.
1,000,000%. So I do want to touch on that, because that's such a good point that you brought up. You know, throughout my 20s and after the first time that I tried drinking, right? It's very unlikely that after that first time that I tried drinking that I would pick up a bottle every day of my life moving forward after that. That's typically not how alcoholism works. So it's a progressive disease. So you would go, I could see my disease progressing once I recognized it. Like, I went from drinking one night a week to then two nights a week, to then three nights a week, to then four nights a week, to just whenever really I knew I had the next day off, or even a lot of the times whenever I didn't have the next day off, I was drinking. And so into my 20s, one thing that really escalated my drinking into hyper mode was I started bartending. And at the job that I worked at, in the restaurant that I worked at, it was a sports bar. And it was encouraged to drink while you were at work. It was encouraged to have fun with the customers. If they're wanting to drink, offer, like, if they buy you a shot, take a shot with them. They wanted people to stay there and to hang out and to spend money. And that was the perfect storm for me, because then I could drink at work and it was totally acceptable. I mean, how many places can you do that, really?
Yeah.
Not a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I would, every single night that I was there, I was leaving inebriated, because it was okay to do. It was totally fine. It was totally acceptable. So I think that's what really pushed my addiction forward, because I almost felt at that point unstoppable. Like, I'm like, where couldn't I do it? Right. I do it at home, parties, hang out with friends, family, at work. Like, there wasn't really any boundaries during that time.
Yeah. And you're surrounded by literally walls and walls of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then, I mean, how many jobs allow you to drink at work? That's true. That's definitely out of the ordinary. So, did you ever consider quitting your bartending job because of what it was getting you into?
No, not really. I mean, I was at that time, I was young. I look back, first of all, what I used to wear. Oh my goodness. Like, wear like a little referee outfit. And I was young and I was so, I mean, do I ever look back at that time and I'm like, was it fun? Anytime that I visit a Buffalo Wild Wings or another sports bar, I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, I think about how care, like, because it's mindless, more mindless work, but you're there with people. And I did have fun. Like, we would laugh and joke and all the things, but it gets super stressful in moments. And so drinking it at work was like, almost like, like, I had a hard table to wait on. Like, I'll take a shot.
Or I'll, like, I see what you
take a shot and go smoke a cigarette on the back porch area. Like, So during, in that moment, there wasn't really a time whenever I thought, I want to quit because this is causing me to be unhealthy, because I was living in a life of that I thought it was like, I was so glamorous.
Yeah. And that, like, it's a cool job to where you can drink alcohol. And did people at your work know that you had an unhealthy relationship with alcohol?
That's a good question. I don't think so, because again, it's like, it was a norm. So it wasn't something that was out of the ordinary. It was something that almost everybody there was doing.
Yeah.
Or they were drinking, and they were also using drugs. And so that was like another, you know, me sitting up on my high horse, you know, like, well, at least I'm not doing cocaine, or at least I'm not, but I would be guzzling like orange vodka with Red Bull until I couldn't walk barely, and it would drive home, which was absolutely horrible. It was, was no better than anybody else, but I would be like, at least I'm not doing drugs.
Yeah. Still. And I mean, you know, at least you take cognizance of what was happening in your life. You know, it's not easy to say, all right, you know, this is who I was as a person. It takes a lot to accept that this is what I was doing, and it wasn't the best decision. So you continued to work at the sports bar, but did anything change career-wise at all along the way?
Yes. So while I was working in the sports bar, so around this time, there was an oil boom that was going on in West Virginia. And there were all these jobs that were coming up working in the oil and gas industry. And when I was at work one night, this gentleman came in, and he actually offered it to anybody that was in the bar and was like, we are hiring for this job, and you can make really good money. And I wanted to make really good money.
Yeah.
And he said, it's a sales position. So I started working in the oil and gas industry, and it was the weirdest. When I think back to how weird it is that I worked in the oil and gas industry, it's very strange, but it's also kind of empowering, because I was a woman working in a very male-dominated industry. And it gave me thick skin, and it taught me how to stand up for myself and to not let people walk all over me or say anything that they want to say to me. But that's what I did after.
Yes.
Driving around a huge truck, wearing FR clothing, hard hat, steel-toed boots.
were you still, so you quit your bartending job at this point?
So I did quit my bartending job at this point, but I lived like in this, like literally like probably 10 miles away from the bar. So I still lived in the same town, but I did quit my bartending job at that time. And I was working on the oil rig.
Mm-hmm. Now, my next question is, you know, related to your job at the oil rig. Tell me about the incident that turned your world upside down during this oil rig stint.
So this is the hands down the lowest point of my life that I've had thus far. Mm. But I was working, and I'll like give a little backstory. So what I did was I would deliver products to oil rigs. So I would get essentially a hotshot driver from anywhere in the country would drive over a whole entire like semi truck end filled with the products that I needed. And I would have to unload these products by myself into a storage unit that I worked out of. Mm-hmm. And this would happen like once a week, once every other week. And I would always do it by myself. And one day I had help that offered to come and help me unload this truck, which was huge for me because I was in the best shape of my life whenever I was working this job, I'll just say. And so I had three gentlemen that I worked, one being a manager, come down and help me unload this truck. And it was took a huge weight off of my back, and they were like, wow, we're in Morgantown. So for anybody that doesn't know, I was living in Morgantown, West Virginia at the time, which is where West Virginia University is located. West Virginia University, I think almost every year it ends up on the list for the top party schools in the United States. Yeah. So it's a really big party town. And these guys are living right on an oil rig for weeks at a time. And they don't get to see people that often. So they said, while we're in town, while we're in Morgantown, will you take us out? Mm. I said, of course. So I took them to the sports bar that I used to work at because I know people there. And, you know, it's a familiar place for me.
Right.
I know that they would have fun because there's like a bunch of girls that are working there. And I took these guys to this sports bar. We were drinking, and I said, I think, you know, we should go. It was getting really late. And I said, should I drive? I think I should leave my truck here. And they said, no, you'll be fine. We'll just follow you home. So I had one of the gentlemen riding with me, and then my manager and another guy rode behind me in another truck, and I was driving back and up the hill that led to my apartment complex, my phone lit up on my center console, and I looked down at it, and I rolled my truck into a ditch. It flipped four times and it landed upside down.
Four times.
Mm-hmm. And I don't like, I remember very vivid things, but there's also parts of it that I don't remember, but I remember being upside down in total shock. I remember saying just over and over again, I'm going to lose my job. That's what I was most concerned about in this situation, which kills me because I couldn't quit saying it. I really could not quit saying that one phrase over and over and over again. I just kept saying, I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to lose my job. So I got cut out of the truck. My manager had cut my seatbelt to get me out of it. The other gentleman that was in the truck with me, his head was bleeding, and looked at me and they said, they looked at the truck, it was crumbled almost into nothing. And they said, Jenna, we have to run. You have to run right now. And in that moment, I almost did it. I almost was like, do I run? I mean, I'm having these people that I work with, they're telling me to do it. They're telling me to just run away. And I was like, I can't do it. I stayed there by myself until the police got there. And it was so traumatic. I didn't even call anybody. I didn't call my parents. I stayed in a trauma unit overnight, and I didn't call my parents until the morning because I was so embarrassed. And I don't know how I didn't get a DUI that night, because I've talked to some nurses since, and they've explained to me that because there was nobody that got hurt in the situation, that typically what they are more concerned for your safety at the time, mm-hmm. and that if you're okay and there's other people that are okay. So I don't know if that's why I didn't get a DUI, but I always think back to that to think, I wonder if I would have suffered. I suffered a consequence that day. Trust me. I mean, it was terrible because I lost my job. Not only that, those three other people lost their jobs that day because they were with me.
Yeah. And your manager was with you. I just don't understand why your manager didn't say, actually, you know what? You're right. You shouldn't be driving.
Mm-hmm.
And did anyone attend to the other gentleman who was with you in the truck?
No. So that was probably, I mean, I left after leaving the hospital, and then I stayed at my parents' house for the next week or so. I had extreme panic attacks because I was so concerned about him in his head. I thought, something bad could happen to him. He didn't get seen. They just left the scene of the accident. And I thought he could die. He could die because he hit his head really hard. And it terrified me thinking that I could cause harm to somebody else like that. But yeah, it was definitely the most traumatic experience of my life so far.
And was he fine? Like, were you ever able to find out if he was okay?
Yeah, so I was able to find out that he was okay because all of them let me know how much I was terribly disliked after the whole situation. Because what happened is he left his wallet in the truck. And so they were able, on the police report of my truck flipping, his name was on the police report. And we also had trackers that were on our company trucks that mm-hmm. they could tell where we were at all times. And so them losing their jobs, it was terrible. I felt absolutely horrible about it, but they were very angry at me because they lost
what?
Their jobs essentially you because of a decision I made.
You know what, Jenna? I so disagree there. I feel like you upfront said, I don't think I should drive. I don't know if I mm-hmm. should drive. You were the mm-hmm. one who brought it up, even if you were really drunk, like you were coherent mm-hmm. enough to say that. Mm-hmm. They were the ones who encouraged you to drive. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. them losing their job and then having the audacity to say to you, we need to go, knowing that there was someone else in the truck, that's on them. It's not on you. The fact that you didn't get a DUI, I quite frankly think you guys got lucky.
Yeah.
But that's that. That wasn't your, you know, you didn't get yourself into that situation willingly. You weren't willing to drive. So, mm-hmm. you know, well, that's on them and they need to deal with it. But I'm not defending the fact that you should have been driving with alcohol in your system, of course, right?
Yeah.
So how drunk do you think you were when this accident happened?
So it's crazy because I think about my tolerance at that time. And, you know, for years after that accident. So that accident happened in 2014. For years after that accident, whenever I would retell the story, I would say, I only had two beers. And I said it so much, Sabrine. I knew I was lying, but it almost became the truth to me because mm-hmm. I had said it so often. But that wasn't the truth. I drank two beers, but they were tall. They were very, very large beers. Mm. And then I probably had three or four shots. Wow. But when I look back to, my tolerance, I'm like, was that really a lot at that time? Because I could drink so much more than that. I don't remember being, times way, way, way worse off than I was whenever I was drinking and driving.
Mm-hmm.
But I was drunk and I did something terrible that I thank God every day that I didn't hurt another person.
Yeah.
And that, because that could have been, I mean, my life could have been different. I could be in prison right now.
Mm-hmm. And an experience like that can really knock people out of the worst habits. So do you think that the accident made you realize that you had to do something about your addiction?
No, it didn't, which is the irony of it. People will ask me all of the time, like, did you hit a rock bottom? Yeah, I hit a lot of rock bottoms, but none of them pushed me to the point, because at that time, I didn't have any other tools in my toolbox to cope with except for alcohol. So I'm like in this state. It's the worst state of my life. I am like lived through trauma, like real trauma.
Mm.
And with really no, I didn't have any professional help, someone I was working with. And the only tool that I had to reach for was a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And I got myself into this horrible situation because I was drinking. Then I lose my job. I lose my truck, clearly, because that was crumbled into a ball. I had to move back in with my parents. And the way that I coped through that horrible time was drinking, which is crazy.
So do you think anything changed at all after the accident? Even if you didn't stop drinking, do you think anything changed?
I would say I didn't drink and drive ever again. I was really anti and adamant about never drinking and driving for any reason whatsoever. Not even if I had one singular sip of alcohol. But if anything, if that situation did anything, it almost escalated my drinking, because I had right already like trauma and pain that I was masking with alcohol. And then that just was a sinkhole that I had in my life. That was so much shame, so much embarrassment, so much trauma that I just piled on top. And it was like I needed to drink more to mask that.
Right. So, you know, of course, you know, going back to a comment you made when we, you know, right in the beginning, you said that, you know, whenever you had arguments with your dad, for example, you said that you're exactly who I don't want to be. You know, so tell me if you ever felt at any point that you were maybe becoming him or people who you didn't necessarily seek inspiration from growing up.
But I definitely, in one thing that sparked me looking into therapy was in the summer of 2016. I was with my parents and they came down to see me for a weekend. And while my parents were here, I drank the whole time with my dad. And then the day before my parents left, like the night before, I got into a horrible fight with my mom. And I was so mean to her because I was drunk. And she woke up the next morning. So this was like a day before they were supposed to leave. And she said, I don't want to be here. I think we're going to leave early. I think we're going to pack up the stuff and we're going to leave a day early. And that was such a, because I live far away from my parents. I live about 9 hour drive. And I thought my mom, who I love so much, I pushed her to the point where she would give up a day out of the year that she gets to spend with me when I don't get to see her that often. And I felt so much guilt. Again, it goes back to like, I would cause these moments in my life. And then I would feel the guilt and the shame, but mm-hmm. I couldn't, the correlation wasn't there yet. But I remember them leaving, and I still have a journal entry that I wrote during that time. And I wrote down that I'm becoming my dad. Mm-hmm. Like, I see myself in him. I see him within myself. Like, we have this person that I said I'll never become. We have so much in common, and good and bad, right? I have good things that I have from my dad that I've picked up, like a hard work ethic. And he's always taught me that I can do anything that a man does. I am strong. I am capable. But then this disease also, and that's what really sparked me into looking into going to therapy mm-hmm. and talking to someone about it.
Yeah. Well, your father was aware of your addiction with alcohol, right?
Mm-hmm.
But do you think he was ever hesitant about drinking with you because he knew what you were going through?
I don't think so, because he hadn't recognized it, I don't think, within himself enough to make a change. Like, there were so many times where we would confront him about quitting drinking. But when you're in an active addiction, and I look back to, you know, we'll give, for instance, whenever I got into my car accident and then I had my family confront me about my drinking, I was like, you are crazy. I am not going to quit drinking. Like, and this is not what caused this. Like, I was just having a fun night. I was on such a hypocritical high horse and would point the finger at every other family member that I have to say, well, you are doing this and you are doing this and you are doing this. So I think if my dad had ever called me out and said, what are you doing? Or, you know, I don't think he had the ability to quit is the thing. I don't think that
he didn't recognize himself. Like, he didn't think he had a problem, and so he couldn't see it in you.
No, and also I'll throw in there, you know, that is the norm in West Virginia.
Yeah.
You know, West Virginia, that is normal everyday behavior. It's not something that someone would bat an eye at, that you go and you hang out and you drink all day. It's like, so what? Mm-hmm. Not everybody's doing it, obviously, but there's a high addiction rate in West Virginia.
Yeah. So tell me more about therapy, because you said that, you know, that is what pushed me to go and get therapy. So did therapy help you navigate some of those challenges? And how was your first therapy session?
So good. So my therapist's name is Belinda, and I love her so much.
Yeah.
So I my first therapy session with her, I told her why I was in there. And a part of the reason why I went to is I wanted to like fix my family. Like I was more focused really on everybody else in my family than I was myself, which is so ironic. Again, it's like, I couldn't look in the mirror. I was there pointing my finger at other people. And when she asked me, how much are you drinking? I never, ever would tell the truth when someone would ask this question. When I would go to, you know, my OBGYN to go for my yearly checkup or to, you know, my primary care physician, and they would ask, I would say, oh, you know, I'll have a couple of drinks on the weekends, or, you know, how many drinks do you have here? Do you smoke? I'd be like, no, I don't smoke. No, I was smoking like any time that I drank, which is a lot. And she asked me, and I answered honestly for the first time. And I said, I typically drink like 3 to 4 nights a week and like a bottle or two a night. And she was floored. I remember her being shocked. She's like, you're 5'2". That's a lot of alcohol for you to consume. And that was the first time that I had been honest and told someone. So that was a big step for me. And therapy with her, being able to have someone that's able to talk to me and be unbiased and not judge me in a situation, but then also to explain to me the way alcoholism works, allowed me to finally make those connections, to finally see, okay, this, I'm having anxiety, depression. I am feeling a lot of guilt and shame over actions mm-hmm. that I'm taking. I am doing these things, but I'm feeling direct shame over it because it's really not me. It's really not who I am to the core of my being. And it helped me see that alcoholism was causing a lot of the bad that was in my life mm-hmm. where I wouldn't have been able to see it clearly before. And so instead of only having alcohol in my toolbox to use as a coping skill, she helped me develop new coping skills, new healthier coping skills that I could use.
Right. So I know she also said something really interesting to you, and I'll read it out and tell me what this statement means to you. Mm-hmm. Okay. Man takes drink. Drink takes the drink. And then the drink takes the man.
That is one of the first quotes that Belinda said to me that was... I was just shocked because it perfectly described my relationship with alcohol, meaning that once I take a drink, I officially lose all control because I take one drink. After that, the drink takes over and I am no longer in control of the situation. I have given everything up because, again, going back to kind of whenever I was talking about my first night drinking, once I have one drink, I don't have an off switch. It's right. Just, I'm constantly thinking about, I need more and more and more and more. I need to order another drink, or I only have one bottle of wine. I need to go get another bottle of wine. Mm-hmm. I need to go get more alcohol, drink more alcohol until I don't remember the night anymore.
So when you finally heard it from a third party, which is a therapist, that something had to be done about your addiction, what conscious steps did you take to kickstart your recovery journey, and what happened next?
So it was really messy because even though I was going to therapy every single week, I was going every week to see her. It wasn't easy. It's hard. It's hard to break a habit that I had in my life for years and years and years. And I would try to quit. I would make it like 5 days, and then the weekend would come, and then I would just start drinking again. Mm-hmm. And I remember I'd wake up on the bathroom floor Saturday mornings, and I would say to myself, like, what? Get off of this merry-go-round. Like, when are you just going to quit it? Like, mm-hmm. get it together. Mm-hmm. So that was really like the beginning of 2017. I was trying like that whole year, 2017. Like I would try to quit. I couldn't. The longest that I made it was like 2 weeks. And then I had a friend's bachelorette party come up in mm-hmm. September. And I, so silly of me, like I'm like 2 weeks into like a stride where I'm like, yes, like I'm doing good. And I remember saying to my mom, I'm going to try not to drink in Nashville. Go fly out to Nashville for a bachelorette party, which what do you do on a bachelorette party? It's just
right,
like,
exactly.
You're just drinking there. And I went wild, crazy, unhinged because I hadn't had it in 2 weeks. Mm. And then, you know, relapsing. Once I relapsed, I just thought, well, what's the point of even trying anymore? So then I just was
It's like a binge eating episode. You avoid eating anything nice for a long time. And obviously alcohol is not nice, but I'm just saying that, you know, it's a similar reaction where this has happened to me. I mean, I've been into, you know, binge eating behaviors. That's just something I've dealt with for a really long time in my life. And I still have episodes where I will be really good for months and months and months. And then suddenly I'll eat 1500 cheesecakes.
Yeah.
You know, so that happens. And so let's pause here for a second and talk about the effect of your addiction on your relationship. How were things going on that front?
Terrible, because even though I was working on myself in recovery and I was relapsing like every week pretty much, but even though I was trying, it was so hard on my relationship during that time because I wasn't who I am to my core. It affected my relationship terribly because I wasn't treating my boyfriend at the time well. We were arguing all of the time. And I remember, I'll say this, like a little bit off topic, but we have been together for 10 years and we just got married this last October.
Yay.
And yes. So,
hey, hang on. When was your wedding? Like what date?
October 9th, 2020.
Oh my God. My wedding anniversary is October 15th.
Oh, no way.
Crazy, right?
October love stories.
I know.
But I remember people saying to me, when is he going to pop the question? Because we were living together and we had been together for so long. And now in hindsight, I can see it wasn't our time. Mm-hmm. It wasn't our time during that time to get engaged and to get married, because our relationship wasn't in a good place. Mm-hmm. And around October of 2017, we almost broke up. He went and he got a hotel room for a week. Like, we legit were talking about how are we going to do the lease? How are we going to do these things? And he got a hotel room for the week. I went to go see friends back in West Virginia. And I remember driving the whole entire, if you can imagine this, if anybody's ever had a panic attack, I was hungover and he told me he was getting a hotel room, and I drove 9 hours back from West Virginia to Virginia.
Oh my God.
Just pretty much having multiple panic attacks.
Oh my God.
And it was terrible. And I remember getting back and meeting him at the hotel room. We talked and we decided that we were going to give it another like honest effort after that. And that was in October of 2017. Mm.
Do you think your addiction to alcohol ever rubbed off on your boyfriend and now husband? What was it, you know, what was his response to you drinking at home?
I think whenever we were doing things together, like whenever I look back and whenever I was in active addiction, he drank so much more because that's what I did. And I think he did it to
catch up
to me and to not, that was like one of our hobbies, which wasn't like a really productive hobby to have. We didn't really accomplish anything getting drunk and dive bars and playing pool until 2 o'clock in the morning. And now, you know, that I'm sober, he's the unicorn that, you know, like, I'm envious of him. He can have a drink or two and then he's done.
He's fine.
He's like, he'll just have, we went last night to dinner and he had two beers and that was it. And he came home and we just relaxed. I'm like in awe of him. So I'm like, how do you even do that?
I understand. Again, you know, it also depends on, you know, you grew up in a completely different context. It's again, also goes back to the gene pool and all that. So, you know, he was obviously aware of your addiction. Was he, you know, was he doing anything to help you?
So it's crazy because I actually did an Instagram live last night where people were asking about, you know, Phil and our relationship. And it's like, we never had a conversation during active addiction where he said, you know, this is affecting me and it's affecting us. I think you should quit. I don't think he even realized how bad that it was because, again, this is like we met in a bar. Mm-hmm. Like he's known me all of these years as this person. And so when you're wrapped up into a situation, like I even look at I've dated people that were narcissists and it was an emotionally abusive situation, but until you pull yourself out of it, mm-hmm. and then you're able to look in, you can say, wow, that's really messed up. Like what was mm-hmm. going on there? So I don't think he realized whenever I was in an active addiction, that it was really bad until I got out of it. And then afterwards, he was a major, major asset into mm-hmm. my recovery.
And what about friendships? Was, you know, what was the response from your friends? And did you sever any bonds along the way?
Whenever I was in active addiction I was getting sober?
Active addiction?
I would say there would be multiple times when I would do something and my friends would be like, why did you do that last night? Why did there were friendships that suffered, I think, along the way, but I have been able to rekindle those friendships, which mm-hmm. has been nice, because I got to make amends with people and then really get to know them again on a personal level where they've genuinely got to know me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think if I look at my addiction as a whole, it touched almost every facet of my life because it changed who I was mm-hmm. and it made me do and say things that I would never say sober or do sober.
Yeah. So take me to the moment you finally saw the light and you decided, okay, enough is enough. I need to take charge of my life. A time you decided that this is it. I'm putting my foot down.
So I would say it's crazy because I look back to the last day that I drank and it wasn't so final. It wasn't like I was like, this is it. This is the day. Like, I'm going to do it. It was another time where I thought I'm going to really give an honest effort. But I did. What changed on that day was I decided to reach out to my close people. It was my husband, my best friend, and my mom at the time. And I needed their accountability. I knew I couldn't do it on my own. When I was in therapy, right? Like, I'm like, yes, yes, Linda, this is the
day.
I
will do it.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to, like, trust me, I've got this. And I couldn't be trusted on my own. Mm-hmm. I couldn't be just going rogue out there and thinking that I could hold myself accountable. And so I entrusted these three people to say, listen, whenever I want to drink, I need you to say no. And if I come to you and I say, I really want to drink, I need you to tell me no. So November 3rd, I had a girls' night. I went out. I got drunk. I ran a 5K the next morning, which still,
wow.
This was like normal behavior for me though. Like I would do things like this. I would do things like this all the time. I'd get drunk, drink two bottles of wine, smoke a pack of cigarettes and go to like a CrossFit class the next day, which mm-hmm. is 'cause I had this, I wanted people to believe that my life was different than what it really was.
Mm-hmm.
I had to keep the outside looking good when the inside was total chaos. And I asked for the accountability on November 4th after I ran my 5K hungover. And I thought, I'm going to do this a week. I'm going to really try to do it a week. And when I made it to that week, we made a big deal about it. Me and my husband, like, we celebrated. Like, can you believe I did it a week? And then we would celebrate. We celebrated 2 weeks and then a month. And I was so proud of myself, each milestone that I hit. And my husband would make the biggest deal about it. And so would my friend and my mom, that it's what kept me going.
I mean, that's huge. And I'm glad that you decided to celebrate each anniversary, so to say, with, okay, we're going to do something big, right? Because we all want to be validated. Do you think that with how far you had made in your own journey, did it encourage your parents to change their own habits?
Yeah, which is amazing. It's probably the best thing that came out of my sobriety. Other than like my life being totally changed, I was able to show my parents that you can live like a fulfilled life without alcohol, and you can quit it. Like, you can do it. And I remember from my dad's birthday that in 2018, for his birthday gift to me, I wrote him a 3-page letter that I read to him in private in his backyard. And I told him how much I believed in him. I told him, like, you can do anything. I've done it myself. And I believe in you. You can do anything that you put your mind to. And I'm living proof. I can show you that that's possible. And so both of my parents now live a sober life, which is so great. And we had at my wedding this past year. It was beautiful because, you know, I'm not anti-drinking. My husband still drinks. His parents, they still drank occasionally. And my wedding was like a celebration. And so me and my parents were sober. My grandma was there too. And I don't know if she had a glass of champagne. I think she did. I think she had a glass of champagne. But me and my parents stayed sober. It was beautiful at the end of the night because I remember I was like tucking them into bed. We had like a farmhouse that we stayed in.
That is so sweet.
I remember we just sat there with each other and I cried and I said, how perfect was today? It was so much fun. And we were sober the whole time. And my dad hugged me and he thanked me. And it was like such a great moment.
That is so beautiful. I mean, really, I was curious about it. I kept thinking, you know, of course you're making all these strides, but you know, your parents also on the same journey with you. So that's really nice to hear. And do you think that there's a code of conduct now around you in terms of, you know, what are the do's and don'ts? Especially because you've been sober for a while now.
With in general or specifically,
you know, your friends and your loved ones when they're around you, is there a code of conduct in terms of, you know, don't insist on offering me alcohol or don't say this, or are there any rules?
I don't think so anymore. Whenever I first got sober, it was more because I needed more support at that time. But now that I'm really confident in my sobriety, it's funny because I really feel like adversely, like I almost feel like, because I'm so loud and proud about my sobriety, that I almost feel like they really will take a look at themselves and they'll not want to drink as much, or, you know, they'll say, I don't really drink that often. I'm like, it's okay. You can drink. I'm not the sober police here. I'm not going.
Do you think during your entire recovery journey that there was ever a moment when you almost fell back into the puddle?
Yes. I would say I definitely always had cravings, because I'll get this question a lot of like, do you have cravings? And in the beginning, I had so many. It's so hard. But one really pivotal moment, it was probably about 2 months into my sobriety, and I came home from work. So Fridays were like, that's the day to kickstart the binge. That was the day, like, in my addiction. I would be driving home from work. I would stop at Harris Teeter on Colonial Avenue in Norfolk, Virginia. And I would pick up 2 bottles of wine and a pack of cigarettes. And I would come home and sit on the back porch and just drink. And those those Friday nights were triggering. And one Friday I came home and I looked at my husband and I said, I want to drink. Like, I really want to drink right now. I had a stressful day. And he said, do not move. I will be right back. And he went to our favorite sushi restaurant and he picked up sushi and he picked up a sparkling grape juice.
Oh, nice. And
so sweet. And it got me through that moment because yeah. I had the support and I had him there knowing that he loved me and he supported me no matter what.
Mm. Yeah, you definitely need someone to say, okay, let mm-hmm. me stop you right there. And I'm really glad that he was with you at the time because it would have been very easy to fall back into a disarray if you were by yourself.
Yeah.
It's quite possible that, you know, could have happened. During your entire recovery journey, were you able to connect with other individuals or were you able to form a community to help you through this journey?
Whenever I was like looking, you know, online, stumbling through trying to get sober, mm. I remember I was looking so hard for someone that was around my age, that looked like me, that talked like me, that was living a sober life publicly. And I couldn't find it anywhere. I would look on Instagram and Facebook because, like, you look on social media, people, they're advertising their lives in so many different ways. And everybody that I could see and everybody that I knew was drinking and glamorizing it. And that made me feel so isolated because I thought, there's no one, I'm going to lose out on so much fun. And yeah. there's no one that is my age that's doing this right now. Like, what a loser I'm going to be if I'm not drinking because everybody that I know is doing it. There's not even celebrities that are talking about this right now. The only two people I could find was Mike the Situation and Steve-O from Jackass. Mm-hmm. And so around the time that I was 6 months sober,
yeah,
I thought, I'm going to open up a little bit and I'm going to talk about this and I'm going to see what people have to say. I was really proud of making it 6 months. And then I wanted to see the feedback that people would have on something like this. And I, in a very soft way, I said for the past 6 months, it was, to me, it was soft, but now like looking back, it's very clear what I was saying.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I just said for the past 6 months, I've been focusing on my health and listening to what's right for me and not what's right on societal terms. And one of the biggest things that I've done is I've eliminated alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And it was overwhelming, the support and the love and the curiosity and the questions that I got that was in response to it.
Mm-hmm. And have you had people reach out to you saying that they've stopped drinking because you shared your journey? And if yes, how does that make you feel?
Oh, yes, they have. And it is, it just comes full circle. I get teary-eyed thinking about it because I had a lot of conversations last night after my Instagram live where I just did a Saturday sober hangout because Saturdays mm-hmm. were a really triggering day for me. And so last night I just thought, why don't we could hang out all together and talk about sobriety and be a support system for one another. And hearing people say, I found your page and I'm 3 days sober. I'm 3 weeks sober since finding your page. Yeah.
That is something.
Yeah. It makes me feel, because being in a social media space, you get criticized for really anything that you do or put out. And that those messages mean like, make everything that's negative just go away because mm-hmm. it's so worth it for me to share these parts of me that I shared to start out with to give hope to other people, but mm-hmm. I have gotten so much more in return because I do it to make people feel less alone. And then in return, I feel less alone, mm-hmm. and I feel support and I feel love, and it's beautiful.
And you said something about, you know, criticism on social media. Do you ever get, do you get hate for sharing your journey on social? And if yes, can you share a few examples?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm like, dude, I can go on and on and on about, yeah, but please, yeah. Enlighten us.
It's so, I mean, really, I can get hate. I mean, I've gotten hate for advertising brands because I have a sober page where I guess, like, if you offer to support people, you're not allowed to advertise brands, which is so weird. It's the people will nitpick everything that you do in this world. There's what I had to come to realize is it is impossible to please everybody. And so I started to really open up and talk about things that I found problematic in our society, especially with the pandemic and the way that we were living so isolated. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest triggers that people had with what I was speaking out on my page, I'm literally like grasping the wall right now.
Yeah.
Like waiting.
Yeah.
is mommy wine culture. Which,
oh, yes. You definitely mentioned that.
Yeah. It's something that honestly, I think people don't understand when I'm talking about mommy wine culture. I'm not talking about mommies when I'm saying that. It's the societal pressure and the societal norm of using your child as a reason
to drink.
To drink.
Yeah, it's definitely. I think people make it look very funny. Even if you look mm-hmm. at a lot of the reels and a lot of the TikToks where, mm-hmm. you know, the only solution to a mother getting any respite from her kids screaming is opening mm-hmm. a bottle of wine.
Yeah. It was scary. It was so scary to me coming from being a child of an alcoholic. Saying things and insinuating these things to your children that is problematic for so many reasons. I mean, you're like saying essentially like you caused me to drink, which is terrible. And it's a yep. joke. I get it. I don't think that anyone that's posting these things or creating these things, they mean it in malice. They mean it in good fun. Mm-hmm. But there is a dark side to it that I want to bring to light. Because there are women that you might make a reel or you might make a TikTok that you think is hilariously funny and you're pouring a glass of vodka at 9 a.m. to put up with your children that you are doing virtual learning with that you think is funny. There are mothers that are watching those that they are pouring an actual glass of vodka mm-hmm. at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And they see that and it normalizes it for them. And it creates this gray area for women to seek help. Mm-hmm. It is like, on one hand, you're poking fun at a disease. And then on the other hand, it's creating this gray area where people are like, do I or don't I have a problem? Because I'm seeing this on social media pretty
and
much
everyone's
everywhere.
Doing
everyone's
it.
Coping.
Yeah, everyone's doing it.
Coping in this way.
Yeah, and it's cool and it's funny and it's acceptable. Yeah. And all the and you said something really interesting the other day, which was when you whine, which is whine, I whine, yeah. whine. Yeah. You know, yeah, like I've seen that so many times. And I used to think, oh, that's funny. But I realize mm-hmm. now that, well, it's funny to me, but it's not necessarily, it's triggering and it's encouraging of drinking alcohol for people who have an addiction. Because now you have an excuse.
You have an excuse and it looks like everyone's doing it. And I think like a bigger picture for people to look at to maybe understand it more is like, women are suffering because of it, because we're creating all this, these t-shirts, these glasses that say mommy needs wine. There's a children's book that's
what?
Called Mommy Needs Wine.
Oh my God.
And Like ultimately who's suffering is mothers and children. Children are suffering. There are mm-hmm. children that are being neglected in these situations where a mom's like, cannot see the light because everything that she's seeing in our society that we create, the society that we live in, is pointing to this is normal coping behavior because we're living through a global pandemic. Mm-hmm. And the only way to make it out alive is if you're drinking in excess.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I didn't even know about the mommy wine culture. I did a lot of reading around it and I realized, yeah, this is totally tapping into a, you know, creating a customer pool, mm-hmm. creating need for your products. And this is pure marketing. And by the way, I'm in marketing.
It's pure marketing.
Like, I'm in social marketing. Media marketing, by the way. So,
yeah, ha. It's a marketing ploy. I was on another podcast and called Elevating Motherhood, and she described it in a perfect way. She said, mommy wine culture disempowers women.
Absolutely.
Like, it's so true because, you know, we are strong. Women are, oh my gosh, we're incredibly strong creatures. We have, and especially during this pandemic, women had to juggle so much doing work and homeschooling. And, you know, I'm not a mother myself. That was one reason that I got so much hate about
this. Yeah, you got flack because you're not a mom.
Because I'm not a mom and I don't understand how hard it is. However, I am a child of an alcoholic.
That's exactly what I was. That's exactly what I was going to say. I was like, sure, yeah. You don't have the mother's perspective, but you have the child's perspective.
I have the child's perspective, and really, what is the biggest driving force? And I'll get teary eyed even talking about it. Is one of the biggest things that keeps me sober every single day is my future children. I have so much out of my control with my future children, and I understand that, but I want to do everything in my control that I can to not pass the torch mm-hmm. of addiction on to somebody mm-hmm. else.
Absolutely.
And it scares me for the generation of my children to think that everybody, there's so many young adults that are on TikTok and Instagram right now. They're seeing this. They're seeing these TikToks and these reels, and they're going to be parents sooner than we know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's normalizing it for them as well.
Yep. Absolutely. And I think, you know, regardless of what your intent is, I think social is a place where everyone rakes muck at each other. And yeah. I guess that's the reality. And I mean, someone said to me the other day, Sabrine is originally a fat girl, but she pretends to be skinny. I'm like, that is the most complex thing I've ever heard.
What?
How can you be? First of all, like, calling someone fat, I'm like, okay, whatever. But the thing is, how can you be fat and pretend to be skinny? Like, I just don't get it.
One, you know what? This is so random. And you can cut it out of this if you want to, but
no,
my husband and I had a very interesting conversation in the woods. Yes. So I told you before, yesterday we went hiking and then we got lost in the woods for literally, we hiked for 5 hours. It was the longest hike ever. Mm-hmm. That was supposed to just be like a leisurely walk.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we had in-depth conversations while we're hiking, and we got into this in-depth conversation of, intention. And he said one thing that he attributes to a lot of this online bickering that people have, or, you know, this self-righteousness almost that people have online,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of the times people will say something to you online that they would never say to you, to your face.
Yeah.
They would never. And he said a lot of it is, it comes down to intention. And he said, when you describe what you say, what you are doing yourself, you say this, but this was my intention behind it. This was the intention that I had behind it. But we never look at it when we're looking at into somebody else in the way mm-hmm. that they're doing something.
Right.
And I think that would solve a lot of what we're looking at online as far as beliefs and people you know, talking on social media is not immediately saying, well, I can't believe she said this. This is so terrible and offensive to me. Because I look at, you know, women that are posting these mommy wine culture reels or that are selling mommy wine culture things online. Do I think their intention is to make someone feel bad that has alcoholism? No, that's not their intention to do that. Their intention is to make someone laugh or to they think it's funny. But I think, you know, if we could look at more of why someone is doing the things that they are instead of blatantly saying something rude or nasty, it would be a lot nicer.
I'm still learning how to deal with that, Jenna. I don't think I'm great at it. I mean, there are days when I wake up in the morning and I read something really horrible and I lose my appetite. Like, that happens, right? So I think yes, but you are trying to bring in a new perspective. And if you are saying that, sure, you're trying to poke fun at like how annoying kids can be, for example, and how it makes you pull your hair out. And so wine helps you relax. I get that. But my perspective is that as someone who grew up in a household where alcohol was not just something that would calm you down, but it ruined relationships. Yeah. It's a trigger for me. Yeah. So it is totally fine for you to share that perspective. Because, I mean, what kind of a world would we be living in if we all had the same ideas and opinions? And, you know, I think people, it's about tolerance. It's about tolerance. And I think, no matter how educated you are, there is a difference between knowing how to do algebra and being well-cultured. So, it's, you know, so you could know how to solve complex math equations, but you could still be a dick.
Yeah, totally. I agree. I so agree with that. I think we have the ability as human beings to never stop learning and never stop evolving and never, we can do that. There's so much information that we can absorb and learn off of one another.
Absolutely. And so, Jenna, if I were to ask you, looking back, what advice would you give your younger self who is struggling to stop drinking? And if you have any regrets?
I would tell her that you have no idea how strong you are and what you are meant to do in this world. You are going to be able to truly find yourself, and the life that you are going to live is so fulfilling. You are going to laugh harder than you ever have. You are going to love deeper. You are going to form the strongest bonds and impact so many people. So don't be afraid that you're not going to have fun ever again, because it could not be further from the truth. You will start living your life to the fullest as soon as you stop letting yourself hold yourself back. Mm-hmm.
That is amazing. Do you have any major regrets?
I wouldn't say I have regrets, because I look and I see the things that I've been through, and they've made me who I am today. Like, even my car accident was horrific. And do I wish that I wasn't foolish and drove drunk a bunch of times? Of course. I wish I wasn't so silly, because terrible, awful, horrible consequences. You see it on the news all of the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where people will do things. You look at, like, I don't know how we don't point this out more as a society, because you look at even celebrities that have like major embarrassing moments. I don't know if you remember, I don't think it wasn't last year, it was the year before, when Justin Timberlake was like filming a movie and then he got inebriated drunk and was at this rooftop and the paparazzi caught him like putting his hands all over this other woman, and he's clearly like out of it. Like, he is gone.
Oh,
bye
bye.
He drank so much. And you're like, I'm sure he wishes he didn't drink that night. I'm sure he wishes that he didn't drink that alcohol and that he didn't put himself in situations where it can affect your life and your family. Mm-hmm. So I don't think I have, there are things that obviously I'm thankful for that it didn't, I'd never hurt another person. But I don't think that I have any regrets, because I think everything that's happened in my life so far has led me to where I am. And then I'm able to talk openly to shine a light for other people so they can see that they're not alone and that people make mistakes because we're human. But you can live a life of sobriety and you can recover and you can live a life with a disease that's very manageable, mm-hmm. but very fulfilling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think I love that you, you know, I love that you do believe in your heart that even though you made mistakes, you are the person you are because, mm-hmm. you know, they taught you something. And yes, it would have mm-hmm. it would have been nice if the accident didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you didn't find yourself blacked out on the bathroom floor. Yes.
Yeah.
But looking back, I think those are also some of the things that now help you not drink or not, mm-hmm. you know, have that downward spiral. So yeah. Before we wrap up, Jenna, what advice do you have for individuals who are trying to recover from an alcohol addiction or any form of addiction for that matter? What can they do to make an honest effort?
I would say that I'm not an expert by any means, but I can always speak from my personal experience that therapy helped tremendously, and being honest in therapy, because I think a lot of people go to therapy and then you have to be raw and real in order for therapy to work. So being in therapy, being raw, one thing that I did, and I've talked about it just once or twice on my page, but one thing that was really helpful for me was journaling. Mm-hmm. And what I did was, because alcohol, and again, in our society, is very glamorized, and I looked at it as this is my fun. This is my gateway to fun over here. I love it so much. When really, in all actuality, alcohol wasn't causing any fun in my life. It actually was causing a lot of destruction. It was causing me to have anxiety, depression, anxiety attacks, insomnia. And so I, in my journal, wrote down every single time that I made a terrible decision and I messed up and I said something that I didn't mean, or I did something that I wish I could have taken back. And the way that I felt during those times. And whenever I was having a strong craving, I would go back and I would read those. And I would think, I don't
remind yourself.
There. Yeah, I don't want to be there again. Tony Robbins, actually, can you hear me?
Yeah, totally.
Okay. I'm going to look, because I listened to a Tony Robbins book the other day that was really good, that it's called Awaken the Giant Within. Mm-hmm. He talks about trying to overcome hard things in your life. One of the things that he mentioned was addiction. And he said, if you want to quit something, smoking or drugs or alcohol, like, put yourself in the thick of it so you can see what your life will be if you continue down the road of it. Mm. You know, look, visit homeless shelters, visit these places that if you really continue on the downward spiral, like where your life could be, or if you're smoking, go to, like, you can look up like what it can cause to your lungs or what alcohol can really do to your body, like cirrhosis of the liver or fatty liver disease, these things, because it kind of shocks you. Then you're like, oh, wow, yikes. This is like,
this
what
could be me.
Could
yeah.
Come. Yeah. This is what could come out of it.
Yeah.
And reaching out for help. There's still such a stigma with mental health, but especially with alcoholism. There's an amazing community now on Instagram. If you just look up the word sober, you'll find so many amazing accounts to follow. But reaching out for help in a professional way, because if I didn't have someone, I described this on my live last night too. It's like, if for some reason I had to rewire the electrical wires that were in my apartment right now.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that on my own. I'd have to call someone on the phone, mm-hmm. an electrician, a professional, to say, hey, this is what I need done. Can you help me do this? With mental health, it's the same thing. Again, I go back to, like, I only had using alcohol as my coping mechanism. So I had to reach out for professional help so someone could show me the way.
Mm-hmm.
And no one should have shame over that, because it's a way that you're helping yourself, you're loving yourself, and you affect your life in the best way possible when you really do the deep digging in the work to live your best life and become the best version of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, you said things that you shared wisdom that can literally be applied to any life situation, not mm-hmm. just, you know, for someone who's dealing with an alcohol addiction. So thank you mm-hmm. for sharing that. And
yes.
Jenna, you have been wonderful. Thank you for being so candid with us. And thank yes. you for, you know, your valuable advice. Where can our listeners find you and learn more about you?
Thank you so much for having me. First of all, this was a pleasure. And like I said, I was honored that you even asked me. So they can find me on Instagram. My name is Jenna DiLullio. So it's JennaDiLullio. And then I also have a website that I just launched 2 months ago. So
Yay.
It's JennaDiLullio.com.
Yeah, I think I came across it. I will check it out for sure. And again, thank you, Jenna. And yes. thank you to all our listeners for sticking with us till the very end. This is a long episode, but hey, there's more in store for you. So stay with me, because I will be back very soon with another powerful journey of perseverance. But till then, keep your chin up.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hello there.